Demonology and the Tri-Basic Model of Trauma, an Integrative Approach. A Good Omens fanfic written by NNM and performed by Starcatcher Betty. Chapter 8. Protective Factors. There was something she had to do, and she had been putting it off. She had been putting it off because she didn't want to do it, because it was easier to put it off than to do it. She had put it off until the point when she felt like she couldn't safely put it off any longer. She had to do it before it was too late for her to do it right. "There's something I want to talk about before we get started," she said at the start of the session, after they had both sat down. "Just a heads up." "Okay, sure," he said. "I'm going to be unavailable for a month," she said. "Oh," he said, and then he looked at her. There was this thing he did, the specific way he had of looking at her. When he did it, it felt like there was a warping to the room's air, like everything had grown just slightly too still, like he was purposefully restructuring the space between them. She didn't know if he actually was doing any of that. She didn't know if there was some sort of demonic thing or if she felt was just an emotional reaction to some subtle set of micro-expressions and shifts in his posture. She couldn't tell. All she knew was he had done this at some point or another in each session they had since they talked about the tree, and he did it on purpose. And when he did it, she knew that he was saying, "I can see you, and I can listen." It set her teeth on edge every time he did it. And he must have known that it did, but he kept doing it anyway. The tree was over by the window these days. "We'll meet next week, and the week after that, and then we'll be taking a month-long break," she said. "Sure." "We've never taken a break that long." They had never taken a break at all. Aubrey time wasn't one for vacations. "A month's not actually that long a time," he said, and then he added, "not for me." "You might be surprised," she said. According to the triphasic model of trauma therapy, there are three different phases to trauma work. Not one of those phases, however, is the take-a-month-long break phase. Not one of them is get halfway through processing the trauma and then leave your client for a full month phase. Not one of them is just go off and do fuck-all phase. And this, Aubrey Time knew, was because trauma processing wasn't the sort of thing you can just half-ass. It can be risky. Trauma sits in the brain, like an eternal and nightmarish actuality. And trauma processing requires working with that nightmare, confronting it, not ignoring it, but pushing on it. Trauma processing is not the sort of thing that a professional like Aubrey Time would want to get halfway through and then stop for a full month. Trauma processing is the sort of thing that a professional like Aubrey Time understood herself to have a duty to do properly, a duty that was vital to the safety and well-being of her clients. A professional like Aubrey Time would be able to keep fucking control of her life so she can do better than abandon her client halfway through processing his trauma. "Any thoughts or feelings coming up, thinking about being away for a month?" she asked. "What about you?" He was still looking at her. He was still doing the thing. This was part of their dynamic, when he was doing the thing. His honesty became currency. He held her to high prices. She shifted her eyes over to the tree. Just let them flick in that direction for a quick second. It wasn't an answer, but it was. "I'm not going to ask where you're going," he said, like it was reassuring, like it was an expression of some shared ground rules. "I didn't say I was going anywhere," she said, because it was reassuring, because it was an expression of her actual ground rules. And you didn't answer my question. Any thoughts or feelings about this?
Nah, he said. Sounds good, actually.
If Aubrey Time could, she would completely ban the words good and bad from Crowley's vocabulary. Sometimes he used good to mean bad, but also sometimes he used good to mean good, and sometimes he used bad to mean good, and other times he used it to mean bad. It was confusing. It got them stuck in pointless circles.
We both know you need a break,
he said after she hadn't responded, and he sounded a little hesitant. He sounded a little sad, and he also sounded like he was trying to hide it. It made her stomach clench. At least, though, he stretched out. He stopped doing the thing. We can talk more about it next week, and the week after that, she said, working to reinforce the timeline. For now, though, how about we get to work?
Sure, he said.
He got prepared, settled into his chair, getting comfortable. Aubrey Time had a plan, or at least part of one. She would have them work on the book today, and then they wouldn't the next session or the session after that. They would work on the book today, and she believed the chapter that they would work on would be good enough for her plan. It wasn't the best chapter for them to work on, not for her plan. If she had started planning earlier, she would have managed things so the last chapter they focused on before she abandoned him for a month was the Ritz, or retirement. But at least they weren't on the very central chapter, the fire, or after the fire. The chapter they were on, while not ideal, would give her what she needed for her plan to work. Or at least she felt reasonably assured it would. She knew the outline of events in Crowley's trauma narrative, at least in broad strokes. She knew the chapter that they set to work on today involved a disagreement between Crowley and Aziraphale. She also knew, from significant experience by this point, that just about every single story Crowley had to tell about himself and Aziraphale involved them disagreeing, bickering, snipping back and forth. She knew how he smiled when he told these stories, how he lit up, even as he acted frustrated and annoyed. She knew that he liked and admired Aziraphale's spunk, and that she thought was something she could plan around. For this session, as the last time they would work with the trauma narrative before she abandoned him for a month, her plan was to focus on a section of the book which, she believed, would highlight Aziraphale's spunk, the loving dynamic they managed to maintain through gripes and huffy disputes. That was her plan. Okay, she said when she was ready to begin. Let's work on Chapter 5, The Bandstand. They got to work. After the hour was up and he had fleshed out the chapter, after he had recounted everything he remembered about what he had said and everything he remembered about what Aziraphale had said, after they had ended and he had left, Aubrey Time slumped down in her chair. Well, fuck, she thought. It had been a crap plan. As a general rule, psychotherapists do not approve of euphemism. Euphemism stands in the way of truth. It stands in the way of clarity. Euphemism comes with plausible deniability, and plausible deniability rarely has therapeutic value. Euphemism, in some certain circumstances, can be dangerous. What psychotherapists have in place of euphemism is technical terminology. They have a full language that allows them to discuss the most challenging topics with less pain than those topics deserve. They know what they mean when they use their technical terminology. And they also know that the technical terminology can, sometimes, make it easier to discuss what they need to discuss with one another. They all understand the very practical implications of the painful topics they have to discuss. They give themselves the comfort of technical terminology because they know, for some topics, they need all the comfort they can get. What they talk about is risk. An individual's risk falls on a scale between low and high. There is no one who is zero risk. There is no client in any circumstance who is deemed to be completely free of risk. Everyone, at all times, is at least low risk. What psychotherapists do is complete risk assessments. They do this by asking questions. Questions which have none of the euphemisms, none of the safety provided by the technical terminology. They ask questions that are blunt and direct, because these are the questions that allow them to establish a client's level of risk. The questions they ask are, do you ever think of killing yourself? Have you in the past? Do you ever think of hurting or killing others? Have you in the past? They ask these questions because it is their job to ask these questions. They ask these questions because they need to know the answers, because it is their duty, above all else, to protect their clients' lives. They ask these questions and they take them seriously because there are so many for whom the answer is yes. The fact that someone answers yes to any of those questions does not mean that they are high risk. Suicidal ideation, thoughts of one's own death, are in fact fairly common. Answering yes to these questions does not mean that the client is in crisis, another not euphemism, another way of describing something terrifying and all too common for a professional therapist. Answering yes, instead, simply leads to a variety of additional questions, and one's answers to those questions determines where one falls in terms of risk. Clients do not always take the risk assessment questions seriously. They do not want to take them seriously. Some clients do not want to believe that those questions could be relevant to themselves, and others do not want to have to give them truthful answers. So they joke. They give silly, funny answers, as if the topic could be funny, as if their answers couldn't actually matter, as if it would never even occur to them that their therapist would have to take even those jokey, silly answers seriously. They joke and they have fun because they haven't had to sit with a client in crisis. They haven't lost a client to pointless death. They haven't spent months or years in therapy of their own, trying to look back and figure out how they had failed someone in their care so seriously. When Aubrey Time first sat down with Crowley, that first session they spent together, when he had asked about Oedipus and she had taught him a grounding technique, she had performed their risk assessment. She had asked her questions, blunt and to the point, and he had not joked. He had not laughed. He had taken the questions seriously. He had taken the questions seriously, and he had lied through his teeth about them. She had been able to tell that he was lying about the answers. She had pushed him on it, gently, carefully, because they had not formed a therapeutic alliance yet, because he had been so angry and untrusting back then. But she had pushed him, and he had kept lying. There comes a point when someone is lying to you when there is nothing you can do but accept their lies. She had put him at low risk. For a client who is low risk, a therapist might not even ask those blunt questions again. But risk assessment was never a one-and-done sort of thing. Risk assessment begins with blunt and awkward questions, and then it continues regularly, session after session, through a variety of careful observations and less direct inquiries. Aubrey Time still put Crowley at low risk. At least Aubrey Time put Crowley at low risk for suicidality. Homicidal ideation was a completely different matter. She supposed that she could successfully count him as a low risk of homicidality, given that he never presented any realistic fantasies about harming specific identifiable humans. She was willing to accept that. That was perhaps the best that she could ask for a demon. The fact that, from Aubrey Time's professional opinion, Crowley was low risk did not leave her too reassured in light of her upcoming month-long absence. She thought perhaps it should leave her more reassured. She thought perhaps that the growing concerns she had about him, along with all the rest of her clients, said more about her own control issues than anything going on with their actual risk levels. But still, she wasn't reassured. Related to an individual's level of risk were the client's risk factors. There were certain factors to an individual's personality, life history, and external circumstances that make it statistically more likely that he will kill himself. And Crowley, for his part, had a variety of risk factors. The biggest one, in Aubrey Time's professional opinion, was his impulsivity. Anthony J. Crowley had an impulsive streak a mile wide. He was impulsive, and he was prone to fits of despair, and he was halfway through the painful and distressing process of working through his trauma narrative. And it just so happens that the mixture of pain and distress in someone with an impulsive streak a mile wide, who is also prone to fits of despair, could be very, very bad. Still, Crowley was low risk. Along with his risk factors, he also had a significant protective factor, or something that lowered the statistical likelihood that he would hurt himself. It was preferable, of course, for an individual to have a wide variety of distinct protective factors, but Crowley was different. Crowley may have had only one significant protective factor, but the protective factor he had was the most powerful fucking thing Aubrey Time had ever encountered. Crowley was low risk, and she believed he would likely remain low risk so long as the whole of his life could stay comfortably curled around Aziraphale. All she wanted to do, all she wanted before she left him on his own for a whole goddamn month, was to reinforce the meaningfulness and significance of his connection to Aziraphale as much as possible. Let him lean into Aziraphale fully and completely, and she could feel safe leaving him for a full month. There is no such thing as no risk. There's only ever low risk. Her plan had been a crap plan. It would have been a better plan, less prone to failure, if she hadn't put off talking to him about her impending time away for so long. And now she only had 2 sessions to come up with something better. "I've got a handout for you today," she said at the start of the next session. "Oh," he said. There had been a time where she would have interpreted that as a sarcastic response, but she knew better by now. She knew, by now, just how much Crowley enjoyed handouts. He loved them. He loved that. Sometimes they had typographical errors. And then he could hold up the handout and point them out to her until he had completely pissed her off. He loved that sometimes they were printouts of scans and photocopies, and he could pretend not to be able to read the words on the page. He loved that sometimes the images didn't line up with the text. One time, a handout had been in Comic Sans, and that had made his whole day. Aubrey Time did not make these handouts. She never would have chosen Comic Sans. She didn't make typographical errors. He still loved giving her grief about it, though. "You're really going to like this one," she said, hamming it up, knowing just what cards she had in her deck. "It's from a self-help book." "Ooh," he said, even more enticed. "Sounds horrible." She was holding the handout upside down, so he couldn't see it. She handed it over to him, upside down, as well. He could only see what the handout was once it was in his hands and he had flipped it over.
"Oh, this is shit," he pronounced with dismay as soon as he saw what it was.
But it was too late. It was already in his hands. He was stuck with it now.
"I know," she said, and she couldn't help but grin.
She couldn't help but grin because it really was shit. And maybe she hammed it up a bit more than necessary because she knew she would get that reaction from him.
"We're going to talk about it anyway."
The Five Love Languages was published in 1992. It was, in Aubrey Time's professional opinion, just as it apparently was in Crowley's, shit. It was crap. It was bullshit. It was not, in her opinion, the lowest of the low of self-help nonsense, but it was pretty low. However, she also knew sometimes even bullshit could be helpful. Sometimes, when you've got a pesky nail to deal with, you just need any hammer. Not necessarily a good one.
"So, what is it?"
he asked, putting no effort into reading it at all.
"It's just a way of describing how some people go about expressing their feelings for those they care about."
"Love," the handout said. The word used was love, but she didn't say that. "Different people express how much they care for each other in different ways."
The best element of the Five Love Languages, in Aubrey Time's professional opinion, was the accuracy of the title. You're promised five love languages, and that's exactly how many you got.
The five languages were words of affirmation, gift giving, acts of service, quality time, physical touch.
"Some people," she continued, "are really good at showing how much they care about someone in one of these ways, but not in others. And sometimes someone might not even realize that someone else is trying to show how much they care because the two of them expect care to be expressed in different ways. Go ahead, look it over."
She gave him a pointed look until he gave in and started reading. This was one of the more professionally designed handouts she had, unfortunately, which meant there weren't any typos for him to find. It wasn't as fun as he had hoped.
"All right," he said, resigned, and he leaned back a bit in his chair. "I know what you're getting at."
"Oh yeah? What's that?"
"Me and Aziraphale."
"Uh-huh," she said, using the full extent of her professional skills to bite back the "no duh" that had settled in her throat. "So, what do you think about it?"
He shrugged. It was either a thoughtful shrug or a bored one. The two states could be remarkably similar for him.
"Can you recognize yourself in any of those?" she asked.
He gave in. He actually started considering the different languages described. He made small clicking noises with his tongue as he looked them over.
"Don't know," he said, still looking at his options. "Maybe all of them? Maybe none? Can't tell."
"Are you fucking kidding me?" she thought.
"It can be subtle sometimes," she said.
"Words of affirmation are right out."
He got that right, at least.
"Look, there's a quiz you can take." It wasn't an assessment. It wasn't a screening. It wasn't a test. It was a quiz, for fuck's sake. But she could sweeten the pot. "Oprah took it live on TV once."
Oh. His tastes, while not simple, were at least remarkably predictable. She already had it, ready to go on her end table. She handed it to him, along with a clipboard and a pen. She watched as he took it, as he counted up his score, as he looked at the results.
"Huh," he said.
"Acts of service," she said. He hadn't shown her his score, but really, come on.
"I suppose."
"Mm-hmm."
"And then there was that time."
"Mm-hmm." "And I..." He stopped himself, looking up.
"You're not surprised?"
"Crowley," she said, and she couldn't help but laugh a little. I don't know how you could be any more obvious. He seemed to accept that.
What do you think Aziraphale is?
You know him better than I do. What do you think? He ended up taking the quiz again. But this time, he had imagined what Aziraphale would say.
He got a tie, Crowley said when he was finished, sounding offended by the results. Both acts of service and quality time.
That happens sometimes.
It did. The quiz was bullshit.
Does that sound right to you? He didn't respond, because he was thinking. He was thinking and his face was turned downward, like he was confused, like he didn't know what to think. He was thinking and she was starting to worry that his thinking wasn't going the way she wanted it to. She decided to direct. Can you come up with any examples where he showed you how he cared about you in one of those ways? Now his brow was furrowed. Now his lips pursed. He wasn't looking towards her. He was looking away. Well, fuck, she thought. She'd try a different route. Maybe you can share with me some of the ways you've shown him how you care for him over the years.
Where's my book? He asked, suddenly intent. And no, that was not okay.
I wanted to put off working on it until I got back.
Fine, but let me see it.
She didn't want to let him see it. Can I ask why? She asked, trying to sound uncommitted.
I just want to see it.
Yes, but why?
It's my book. Let me see it.
He was getting agitated now. He was starting to fidget, and his expression had hardened. She didn't want him to see the book, but she also didn't want him to grow upset. How about I get the book, but I keep hold of it?
Fine, sure.
She stood, moved to the filing cabinet where she kept it, and she got it out. She brought it back, sat down with it. She held it in her lap, working to limit his view of it.
Okay, he said, leaning forward, wanting access to his half-done trauma narrative. Read back to me what we did last time.
I don't think that's a good idea.
No, it's fine, he said, a bit too quickly for it to really be fine. I'm just curious. Just read it back to me.
She frowned at him. What had left her most worried about their last session was his effect as they had worked through the bandstand. What he had recounted must have hurt. It must have. But he denied it. He denied any distress, and he expressed none either. That was what had left her most worried. If he had cried, if he had screamed, if he had given any indication that they had access to the deep pain that he must be associating with the bandstand, she would have been less worried. She could control his pain if he experienced it in a session with her. She could not control it if it came out anywhere other than her office. She especially could not control it if it came out while she was gone for a whole fucking month.
It's my book, Herb. Come on, he insisted.
She considered her options. If she refused, then that would be the whole rest of the session. He would be angry, she would be angry, and she would have no chance of getting his attention back where she wanted it. If she relented, on the other hand, then there was a strong likelihood that this session would not be the easy, light-hearted session she wanted. Perhaps, however, he would get to feel the strong emotions he had denied last time, and then she would be a bit reassured. Additionally, she thought, if she was very careful and just a bit lucky, she could actually pull the conversation back to where she wanted it. It was worth a shot. Okay, you win, she sighed out. She flipped through the papers until she found the work that they had done for the bandstand. She gave him one final look of warning, and he gestured to hurry her along. So she read. Aziraphale and I met up at the bandstand, she read out loud. I wanted him to go to Alpha Centauri with me. He wanted to go too. I told him I'd make sure he was safe. I told him we would both be safe out there. I told him that if he couldn't trust me after all this time, then what was even the point? The world was ending, and I just wanted to keep him safe. I told him that we were on our own side, not either of the other two. She paused there. She looked up to him. He looked like he was concentrating. Crowley hated his book. She knew he hated it. He hated that she wouldn't let him include any actual goddamn sonnets, but it also wouldn't let him turn it into a joke. He hated that she wouldn't let him rip it into shreds whenever he grew frustrated. He hated all of it, and she knew this. He looked, currently, like he was too distracted to pay attention to how much he hated it. That was worrisome. "You know," she offered, soft and quiet, trying to pull his attention where she wanted it. "Especially after what we've talked about today, I can hear in these words just how much you care for him." He wasn't listening. "Keep going," he said. "I think it's the next bit." Yes, it was the next bit. Of course it was the next bit. It was the next bit that she really didn't want to read. He made the gesture again to hurry her up. She frowned at him again, but she returned to reading out loud. "He said he didn't like me. He said he never appreciated any of the things I'd ever done for him. He said that he'd rather spend eternity with Michael and Gabriel and even that sadistic prick Sandalphon than admit that he ever liked me. He told me it was over, that he wasn't on my side, and he'd never go anywhere with me ever again." She stopped there. The chapter continued, but she suspected that that was the bit that he cared about. He didn't push her to go on. He was sitting very still, and his brow was furrowed deep, and his mouth was working. "Talk to me, Crowley." He just shook his head. "Come on," she said, her voice professional and calm and supportive. "Deep breaths. Stay with me." She watched him as he took the deep breaths. She watched him as he moved his face to the side. His eyes were covered, but she could imagine how they were searching around the room, searching for something to latch onto. "Tell me what you're thinking," she said. "Maybe," he started. He shook his head again. His mouth worked some more before any more words came out. "Maybe he didn't actually say any of that." "That's a real possibility." It was more than a possibility, in her opinion. She had, in fact, put a little asterisk next to sadistic prick as a reminder to go back sometime and ask him if Aziraphale would actually say something like that. She doubted, however, that those words were what Crowley was so concerned over. Trauma affects our memory systems. It was normally a bad idea for her to say something like "our memory systems" in a session with him. As Aubrey Time now knew, she and Crowley had a substantial disagreement about neurology. He had insisted he had none. She insisted, for her part, that he displayed consistent and predictable patterns of behavior which were perfectly in accord with the assumptions that he had, at least, central, sympathetic, and parasympathetic nervous systems matching those of a human. They had agreed to disagree. And today, for this, with how preoccupied he was, she thought perhaps she could rely on their unsteady truce. "I don't think he would have actually said any of that," he said. He sounded far off and scared. He sounded like he wanted to be able to convince himself. "I know he said things. I know he did. But I can't remember now if he said those specific things." She repositioned herself on her seat so she was leaning a bit closer to him. Both of them were now leaning in towards each other. He needed connection. "He said something, and it hurt, and this is how your memory recorded it," she offered. "And I know I left some things out," he went on, and she wasn't sure if he had even heard her. He pulled off his sunglasses so he could squeeze his eyes shut and rub at them with his hands.
I remember I told him I'm unforgivable. I remember that clear as day. I said to him, unforgivable, that's what I am. I left that out last time, didn't I?
Yeah, you did.
But why would I have said that?
He opened his eyes now and he looked at her. And he wanted so badly for her to be able to give him the answer.
I can't remember why I said that. I can't. What could he have said to me so I would say that to him?
She couldn't say. She hadn't been there.
The only beings who had been there had been both angry and upset, hurt and scared,
suffering trauma.
He knows I'm unforgivable. Of course he does. It really is what I am. So what would have led me to saying any of that?
He was starting to repeat himself. She took that as a cue. She modeled deep breathing for him, and then she spoke. You know, Crowley, since his sunglasses were off, she could seek out his eye contact. That would help him stay focused on her rather than get lost back in his looping thoughts. We like to think that the memory is like a camera, like it just records footage, and we can go back and rewatch it whenever we want, exactly how it happened. He didn't see the connection to his situation. She could see the confusion threading through his pained expression. It's not like that, though. What we remember is a big mix of what really happened and also what we felt like was happening and what we feel about it after the fact, too. He nodded. He was starting to follow. His mouth hung open and he turned his eyes away from her. We can't know what he actually said. We're not... She had almost said, we're not omniscient, but she didn't want to know what she would find inside that can of worms. We're not going to know. What we do know, though, is that this is what you remember, regardless of what really happened. I think this tells us how you were feeling when it happened. She gave him some time to think about that. 20 seconds, he thought about that. Let me ask you this, she said, knowing she was interrupting his thoughts. It was worth doing so because she was still working towards her goal. You wrote here that he said he didn't appreciate the things you've done for him. We can interrogate that. Whether he said it or not, we can interrogate if it's true. How's that sound? His eyes turned back to her. He was listening. Does Aziraphale appreciate the things you do for him? She watched as his jaw set. It didn't set in anger or frustration or pain. Instead, it set with what looked like pure certainty. He nodded his head. Do you think he always has?
Always,
he said. She could see tears starting to well in his eyes. That's wonderful, she said, and she let her voice express that she meant it. She smiled. She smiled at him. And let me ask you this. Does he invite you to spend time with him?
Always,
he said again, and he nodded his head. And he lifted a hand to wipe a tear from his eyes. Give me some examples, she said, because she wanted him to list them. She wanted them to be fresh in his mind. He paused for a moment to collect his thoughts and to wipe at his eyes again. Crowley, she knew, was almost never willing to take a tissue.
He's always inviting me places. Ever since Rome. He invited me to lunch. I've always been welcome in the bookshop.
He likes picnics. She heard that pause, and she felt she understood what that meant. She felt she understood what it meant because she knew plenty about Crowley's and Aziraphale's habits. She knew that when Aziraphale invited him to do, more than anything else, was drink wine and get drunk and then drink even more. and she would have been annoyed, deeply annoyed, to think that Crowley had thought to censor himself during a moment like this. She would have been annoyed, but she had work to do. "So you see," she offered, and she ensured her voice was soft and high. She ensured that her voice took on a tone of hope. "What do you think all this means?" He didn't answer right away. He was busy. He was busy with the challenging task of feeling what mattered, of experiencing how much there was for him to feel. "It means," he said when he could, because he had not forgotten her question, "that he's my whole world." "Yes," she agreed. She nodded in agreement. She chuckled slightly, and it was a compassionate, happy sound. "Exactly. And let me ask this. Are you his whole world?" She could see it, the very instant those words registered with him. She could see it because it was like a blow to him. The words registered in his body, in his shoulders, and his stomach, and his lungs. They registered like pain, like sorrow, like horror. They registered like that for him because the answer was obvious. The answer was obvious, and he couldn't deny it, and it hurt for him to acknowledge it was true. "Yes," he said, and he was shaking. And he was the broken little child she so often saw him as. "Yes, I am." It shouldn't hurt to be the subject of unconditional love. It shouldn't hurt, but it often does for those who have experienced trauma, especially those who have experienced early life trauma at the hands of a parent. It hurts because trauma situates itself in the brain, and it stays there, and it makes fear and horror and pain feel normal, and it makes love and acceptance and protection feel like a threat. Early life trauma inverts the world, inverts one's instincts, makes one feel safe when confronted with danger, and endangered when confronted with safety. Early life trauma, especially at the hands of a parent, could deprive you from the sense of love. It could leave you capable of appreciating and understanding and wanting to be loved, but incapable of truly feeling it, of letting it in, of getting to rejoice in it and sing its praises. Aubrey Time understood what Crowley was experiencing. She understood it as the professional she was. She understood it. For the whole rest of the session, he didn't do the thing. From the first time since the tree, she wasn't confronted with the thing. And when he left, Aubrey Time felt just a little bit more relaxed, a bit safer, a bit less at risk. One more session to go.